Christopher Media. Let's make some noise.
Jak ji vlastně budu říkat? Natálie? Nebo Eulálie? To je moc dlouhé a život je tak krátký. Už to mám. Julie. Připadal jsem si jako stvořitel, jako Bůh. A tehdy jsem se rozhodl pro celý život. Budu řezníkem. Byla krásná. A já jsem poznal, že ji miluji.
Welcome to the projection booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me once again is Ms. Kat Ellinger.
Hello, I'm glad to be back so soon.
Also back with me today is Mr. Ben Buckingham.
Hello, everyone.
We are wrapping up our first Czech Timber series with a film from director Oldřich Lipský, 1967's Happy End. The film is something of an experimental comedy, which is as unusual as that sounds. The film runs scenes in opposite order and runs motion backwards from the end of our main character's life when he gives voiceover from the account of his birth to the death. Of course, this provides us with constant ironic juxtapositions. The film was co-written by Lipský and Miloš Makarek, the screenwriter behind some of the best comedies out of Czechoslovakia during the 60s, 70s, 80s, and beyond. We're going to be getting into spoilers on this episode. That is, we'll be talking about the beginning of the film. So if you don't want anything ruined, go ahead and track down a copy of Happy End and come back. We will still be here. Now, Kat, had you seen Happy End before I invited you to be on this episode?
No, which is shame on me, because I'm like quite a fan of Lipský, and I've seen quite a few of his other films, later films. But also it stars Vladimír Menšík, who I bloody love. He's like this guy who just pops up in like literally every Czech comedy. No, I hadn't seen it. So I'm glad you invited me on, because it gave me the push to actually check it out.
Check it out,
yeah.
Oh God!
So, what do you think when you finally checked it out?
Do you know? I think it's his funniest comedy. It's a riot. It was an absolute delight. Absolute delight.
And Ben, had you seen this one before?
I hadn't. This is my first Lipský. I've managed to see half of Lemonade Joe last night before I just like crashed out at 3 a.m., just couldn't stay awake. Yeah, the half of Lemonade Joe I was digging and loving a lot, but I would definitely say, yeah, it was slightly insane laughter, but this definitely had me cackling. It was totally fresh to me, and it felt totally fresh. I'm so glad that I got to see this and have this totally weird, surreal experience with this film with you guys.
I have to admit that after I watched this movie, I then put on another movie, and I was so used to watching things backwards that I was expecting the next scene to be the scene previous. I was just like, what the hell's going on?
Yeah, I had a kind of quiet afternoon, and I think I just went and did cleaning afterwards, because I was just like, my brain can't actually do anything now, so I'm just going to start organizing things on my desk, because that's all I'm capable of. It was just kind of like, I felt like I'd done a gymnastics workout for my brain for the last 70 minutes.
I think once you get into it, though, that whole backwards thing, it's like reading manga. You know, you just, once you get into the flow, because the pages go back to front. So once you get into the flow, it just seems completely normal after about 10 minutes. But very difficult to describe to anyone else. So I was trying to talk to Michael Brook about it earlier and just thought, God, why have I agreed to come on this episode? Because I'm going to have to come out in public.
This is definitely the apex of that difficult to describe to somebody. But as I've been watching a great deal of Czech and Slovak films recently, and I've actually had that problem just generally a lot, because the kind of the bits that stood out most for me from all of these films, even if they were fairly mainstream or even new ones, were the bits that were like this film, where it's just like the boundaries of all things just break apart and it starts overlapping genres and styles and everything. And I feel like they just, the Czech and the Slovaks just do that so wonderfully. And this is like the, I don't know, the speedball cocaine hit version of that.
Yeah, it doesn't take breaks. This movie just, it starts and it goes, man. And you better hang on for the ride. And if you're not paying attention at one point, you're lost. I mean, it's amazing. So I kind of said it at the beginning, but I want to say it again. So the film runs backwards, like literally runs backwards, but yet the lines are said forwards. So like the actions go backwards, but then when our characters speak, for the most part, they are saying their lines forwards. But every once in a while, they'll start speaking backwards. It seems to be whenever it's stuff that we just shouldn't really care about, like legal gobbledygook or like a toast to a dead woman at one point. It just, the dialogue runs backwards. So there's no translations for it. It just says audio is backwards.
Yeah, I know. Yes, this film is quite hard to find, and the fan subs that are out there didn't exactly help the they were definitely part of the gymnastics as well.
Did you have the ones with the green type font?
Oh no, mine were white, I think.
Mine were green, but they were some of them didn't really make much sense, but then others were obviously written in British slang, which added a great other dimension to it.
I just actually came just then from a Hungarian film called The Fifth Seal by Fabrice Zoltán, I think it is. And the subtitles were very well done, but they were very dense. And I think that it was because they were literally translating the Hungarian kind of sayings and terminologies. And so it was very much like the experience of Happy Ending, where you're trying to like unpick these sentences instead of them just kind of easily slipping into your brain. And I think that's like Happy Ending is like that. It's that, even if the subtitles were great, I think you would still have that. There's like every single part of it. Yeah, you do have to kind of like start shifting your brain into different directions to sort of unpick and process and put everything together.
Well, Kat, I'm curious, did yours at the end of the film, a.k.a. the beginning of the film, when there's that title card before the action starts, was that translated for you? Because I actually had to go to a Czech friend of mine and say, what does this mean?
I can't remember now. No, I think it was. I'll have to have a check. I think it was, yeah. It was all subbed, but yeah, some of the subs were a bit random. I don't know if they were done by two people, a Czech person who was writing in English and then somebody who wrote in English, because they seem to go between slang terms and sort of casual British English, and then this strange sort of not making sense English and weird. And on top of that, odd words were just in weird symbols. Just yeah, actually been translated properly.
I remember years ago seeing a copy of Frontiers that had fan subs, and there's a bit where the German characters are speaking German and there were no subtitles, and I just sort of assumed that it was, you know, that there were no subtitles. And then it got to the end of the film with a big dramatic ending, and just before, like, it goes to black, it popped up on screen and said, "Sorry, I do not speak German." And I was like, beautiful, beautiful. I remember that moment more than anything in the rest of the film.
I was watching the Czech version of The Little Mermaid because we're doing an episode of Korky Dansingu, and I wanted to see how the Czech version of The Little Mermaid story.
I love that film. I love the lure, but I also love the Czech Little Mermaid. It's so dark.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a great part when it's our main mermaid, and then she's meeting the new bride of the prince. And in the fan subs, it said, these two actresses are actually sisters.
They were as well.
Yeah, yeah. So I was like, thank you, subtitler.
Nice little bit of trivia.
I appreciate that. Yes, it's the pop-up video version of it. Well, yeah, there's a motto at the beginning, and it wasn't translated on mine, so I went to a friend, and I said, what is this? And basically it translates to, you've made your bed, so now you must lie in it. So I'm like, okay, well, that's kind of neat, because then we start with like our main character in the casket
with a head, a decapitated head. What an opening! That is just so good.
I feel like that is such a perfect way to start the film as well. That it's like, because I remember years ago having to write like my high school exam and having to write on Albert Camus' The Outsider and writing about how like the guillotine represented such finality because it always worked. And if it didn't work, they just rolled it back up again and it worked the second time. It was so rare for it to jam. So if you ended up on the guillotine, that's it. And so seeing that image of the head rolling back up and the guillotine going up and him joining back together and all that kind of thing, it immediately tells you what is going on with the way this film is flowing. It's like everything is going to get undone.
I did want to say before we get right into it, this has got, I haven't seen a lot of his early films, but from the later ones, this is a really short film for Lipsky.
Really short. This is what, 69, 70 minutes, something like
that? I had to check it when I got the file because I thought, bloody hell, that can't be right. Maybe some of it's missing. So they usually border on 1 hour, 45 minutes, although I couldn't have handled 1 hour, 45 minutes of that.
It doesn't feel like a 70-minute film, and not in a bad way. It just, like you said earlier, Mike, there's so much packed in that it's just like, I'm ready to get off.
Well, I'm wondering if, I don't know if there's missing bits, because I know that when I helped do some subtitling work on the fan subs for Adele Hasn't Had Her Supper, or Dinner for Adele, and I remember actually finding two different versions of that movie. There was one where it had a couple extra scenes to it, and they just weren't subtitled at all because the fan subs that existed already were for the shorter version. So then luckily I got to work with some people and say like, okay, what does this line mean? What does this line mean? And was able to piece together those missing bits and put out the fuller version of it. But yeah, it was kind of weird because there's a version floating around. I don't know how this one came to be. It might've been that British TV version. And then there's another one that was off of the DVD that had a little bit more to it. I mean, maybe 5-10 minutes, but yeah, I'm curious if maybe there's a longer version of Happy End out there.
It did seem to work though. So I just think that because of the pacing is insane. I think if it had it been any longer, it wouldn't have worked. It works because it's so quick and you're left at the end thinking, whoa.
It worked for me, and it also didn't work for me, because we have at the very beginning, we're hearing his life story from birth to death as we are watching from death to birth, basically. And there's a lot of things that he's talking about in voiceover that we don't necessarily see at the end of the film that you would think we would get. Like, there's a great part because our main character is executed at the end of the film, and then we get to see him in jail before he's executed. And as he's in jail, he starts talking about how he was in this, school with all these boys, and they separated the boys from the girls, and we did all these, fun gymnastics and all this stuff as we're seeing the prisoners being worked out. And so we never actually get to see him with the little kids and then with a voiceover talking about the prisoners, because I thought there would be a mirror of this film where he's talking about one thing at the beginning of his life and then we would see the beginning of his life later on. But the beginning of his life goes like that once we get to a certain point.
Your brain is trying to make too much sense of this film by expecting that.
Because
we kind of trained to like to find a way to process it. And I remember I was thinking a lot about Time Crimes while watching it, because I think that that's the film that I think it is most like, even though they're quite drastically different, obviously, in every way. But I remember hearing an episode of Night of the Living podcast, and one of the guys on that just could not get over the him holding up his fingers for binoculars in Time Crimes, and how that like made no sense. There was no way to explain it. There was nothing in the film that made a reason of why he would be doing that. And I kind of thinking about it at the time, my explanation was the Time Crimes is less a film and more of a thought experiment to show the illusion of narrative. It breaks all of the narrative apart so that our idea of cause and effect and reason is just a complete artificial construct that actually has no meaning and is something that we have to bring ourselves. And I feel like this was doing that to an even more extreme way of just showing that, you know, that our narrative and cause and effect, we can actually force a pattern onto anything and everything. And so the film is almost kind of like fighting with you to refuse your attempts to put a pattern onto it.
I can glorious. Totally see that.
That is just so glorious. I love it.
When the executioner cuts the cord for the guillotine, the main character is talking about that they cut it was basically the cutting of the umbilical cord happens at the same moment. Like in voiceover, the cutting of the umbilical cord happens at the same moment of the cutting of the cord of the guillotine. It is so wonderful. And then you get these great juxtapositions when he's getting his final cigarette and the priest says to him, "You'll meet the Lord in the nick of time." And then he goes, "That's disgusting." And he's talking about the cigarette.
Well, the juxtaposition of the reverse sentences is just genius. I'm not a big fan of behind the scenes and I don't listen to many commentaries these days, but I would just love to know how long it took them to write this. It's like, because I feel like once they'd written it, it's there. It's then relatively easy to construct, but the actual writing process would have just been like mind-boggling.
Well, the design on it is amazing because when they run backwards, they've got these lines like, "That's disgusting." So it's like the whole thing's been written backwards. I'd love to know how they did that because it's perfect. It's all the way through. It just doesn't miss a beat on that. It's just so good. When you run them back, you then find yourself running the conversation in logical order back in your head to see what they did.
Yeah, you reach a point where you are with the movie so much that you're just reading things backwards as the scenes progress. Like there's a wonderful scene, and I know I'm jumping ahead quite a bit here, but this wonderful scene at a dinner table, and the camera is rotating around from character to character to character throughout almost the entire thing. And just each one gets a line, and then the next one gets a line, or in this case, the previous one gets a line. And yeah, just the way that conversation is built is just amazing. Like, "Is there something you wanted to say?" "Yeah, I'd like some rum." And it's like, what?
And yet it's still like, even as it sort of feels like it's pulling the whole conversation apart, you get the sense of the fear and panic in that scene as he's having to deal with these quite difficult things that are going on in his life.
Well, public gatherings for Lipsky, and a lot of his comedies are always these kind of ridiculous farce situations where everyone's really stressed. So this is kind of like this on steroids, because all of his comedies are complete. They're not as surreal, narratively speaking, but they're always really madcap and really just farcical. But this just takes it to the extreme, which was brilliant to see.
Yeah, the scene where immediately after he's sort of exited from prison and they're going to give you a wife and you have to put it together it's such a, like, you're already kind of displaced, and suddenly it becomes a scene which you're like, wait a minute, this is really horrific and yet not. I feel like the film is kind of stressful itself, not just because but there are a lot of stressful things in it for this main character, but also because you're trying to process these like discordant kind of experiences of more than any other black comedy. I felt like I should not be roaring with laughter as much as I was as he's cutting his wife back together. When I was trying to Google some information about it, it popped up as like clips of it on YouTube, and it was like gory Czech film, and I'm like, I guess, that is horrific, but I was laughing too much to notice.
That was the bit, though, because that's kind of like 5-10 minutes in, that was the bit when I suddenly clicked and thought, I see what game we're playing here. When he starts assembling the wife and saying, oh, they gave me this wife in this suitcase and I just have to put her together. I just thought, oh my God, this is just so good. But it suddenly, that's because I was confused for about 5 minutes. I kind of knew what was going on, but that was when I got into the vibe when he puts the wife back together, which is great after all sawn up body parts and stuff. But the bit that follows when you find out why she's been murdered is with the lover who's been, you know, the way so the way it's phrased, I think was the funniest part for me. He's obviously killed her because he's caught her with another man who he's pushed out the window. But you get it back to front. So you get this scene where he turns up. And he's outside and she's trying to hide the lever and it's all going backwards and it looks like they're doing this crazy dance. And then he's obviously been thrown out the window, but he jumps back in. So the main character describes him as rudely flying in because he believes this woman was made for him. It's like, I just thought this just, oh.
Yeah, and you get such a deflation of catharsis as well, because normally you have the build up of towards the violence and the revenge and all this, and instead it's like, oh, I'm still stuck with him. It's like you can't get away from the wife, you can't get away from the lover. They keep returning as they're being introduced into the world, but it's when they're exiting and you're just like, "What? Oh God, I don't know." I've been working nights. I've been finishing up work at like 6 a.m. and I've been juggling a film festival and I've just like barely slept. And I sat down to watch this at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And every last little remnant of a sense of time in me died. I just like, that's it. I'm broken. I'm out. You know, it could be 2027 and God knows what time right now, and I would have no idea anymore. And I felt like the character was definitely lost in that as well.
This movie, I mean, I talked about how the Lord will save you and that's disgusting. I mean, or you'll see the Lord. And I mean, this movie, it's so subversive in its humor. And we talked last week on the show about The Cremator and saying like this could only be made before, you know, the Prague Spring really took effect, that the communists really took back over. And this is kind of the same way, this 1967, and just the way that he's like, when he's still in prison and he's looking around and he's talking about all the other boys in his school, quote unquote, and he's just talking about how eventually they'll grow up to be, you know, tomorrow's generals and ministers. But here he is with this voiceover looking at all these other prisoners and he's just like, I thought there had to be generals and ministers among us. And I'm like, oh, that's great.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of those sly digs just sort of not too subtly hidden in there.
You do find though, even in the later comedies, Lipsky's comedies, there's always this macabre or morbid element. Like a lot of these farce comedies, and I know we're going to talk about the writer later on, but things like You Were a Widow, Sir, and I Killed Einstein and things like that, the plot always centres on someone trying to kill someone else. Or so they are really macabre. Their humour is very, very black and macabre anyway, although they got a little less subversive as they went on, just went into this gloriously silly thing. Or Adele Hasn't Had Her Dinner. Very dark and gruesome. So
even though I only saw the first half of Lemonade Joe, even that where it's very much setting up, well, here's the bad guys who are your traditional villains, but they're bad because they're selling alcohol. Whereas, like, the hero is like, oh, I only drink lemonade, which helps me kill people better. And it's like a good, pious Christian woman is like, oh, he's so fabulous because he can shoot straighter than everybody else. And it's that same thing.
We're talking about the dialogue going backwards, like when he's at his trial and the lawyer's like, well, who put the corpse there? And then the next line is, the judge, maybe? And I was like... I mean, I'm laughing out loud at this movie, which doesn't happen very often, but yeah. And then when it comes to him putting the corpse back together, oh my God. Yeah. I was laughing hysterically at this part because it is just, it's so morbid and so wonderful. And him talking about the body parts as he's cutting them apart or in this case, putting them back together. and that he is talking about how when he, you know, is a young man, how he decides he wants to be a butcher, and it just fits so well with everything. And I mean, because it's one thing to have the motion backwards, to have the plot backwards, but then to have this counterpoint of that voiceover is just, man, it is brilliant.
Yeah, it is brilliantly handled, and then the performance by Vladimir Menzik is just phenomenal. He's just like all of that humor and the horror of it and everything, and the way he's just like his eyebrows and his like mouth and just moves so fluidly that it goes with all the kind of motions and just keeps the whole emotional drive of the film running as well and keeps you linked in with it. It's a really remarkable performance.
Well, I love him, as I said before. He's in so many Czech films, especially Czech comedy films. Like, he's in The Cremator. He's in Who Wants to Kill Jesse. Some of the earlier ones, he's got smaller roles, but then in the 70s, he started to take bigger roles. But I was trying to think of a kind of Western or English equivalent, and I can't really think of one, but he's one of these familiar faces that he pops up in Czechoslovak film and you think, oh my god, it's him, he's just so familiar. But then Lipski used a lot of the same people anyway, and you see these same faces come up, but he's one that just stands out. Vladimir, I love him. He's great in everything he does. And he's always got these ridiculous roles like here, but he plays them completely straight. It's just so good.
Yeah, I agree. I'm trying to remember the first time I ever saw the guy, but yeah, it was one of those like, oh, it's that guy again.
Yeah, he's one of those, isn't he? It's like, oh, it's him.
Well, it's like a great character actor who finally gets a starring role. You know, this is his not his Tree's Lounge, but this is up there. You know, he's not quite a Buscemi, but he's there as far as like just popping into roles here and there, and then suddenly, every once in a while, he'll get a full starring role, and this really shows just how great his range is.
I love him in The Girl on the Broomstick, actually. He plays the kind of this, like, I don't know how you'd describe him, like kind of a vampire character who's in charge of this wizard school, and he's got silly teeth in that. But he's just great. He is just so good. So seeing him there, I was like, shame on me for not seeing this, because I do make a point of, if his name's in a cast, I'll watch the film, because I just know it's going to be good.
He was in a movie from 68 called Marathon or Marathon, and I'm still trying to find subtitles for that one because it's a army comedy, and I'm sure it's fairly subversive as well. And even just looking for it, I found it in full on YouTube, and the first scene I saw, he was in it. I was like, okay, good. I need to see this whole film, but I can't really watch these without subtitles. I mean, because there are too many good jokes that happen in the subtitles.
In The Cremator, was he the crazy couple that kept popping up and interrupting everything? Was that him? Yes. Yeah. I just saw we've got the Czech and Slovak Film Festival going at the moment, which I'm involved in, and we just screened The Cremator on Wednesday night. So it's fresh in my mind, but I was like, wait, who was he in it? And then I was like, oh, of course. Because, yeah, it feels like he might have fallen sideways out of Happy End into The Cremator.
When I think of movies told backwards, I tend to think of mysteries or films where we want to see how things got to be the way that they are, things like Memento or Irreversible. And this one, you think you know exactly how things are going to go because of that voiceover, and it feels like, okay, yeah, I can tell you everything that's going to happen, and I'm kind of wondering, like I mentioned earlier, what's the counterpoint to this? Like, are we going to see him, quote-unquote, assembling his wife at some point? Are we going to see the cow that he's probably talking about when he's talking about we see the little girl who's drinking all this milk, and he's talking about what it sounds like he's talking about a cow and how the cow gives so many liters of milk, but it seems like the little girl is giving so many liters of milk a day.
And the stealing the fish from the seal at the zoo and stealing loaves of bread from the hippo. Like, obviously, if it was forward, he'd be throwing the fish to them, and instead the seals are regurgitating the fish up to them. And he's just like, he's talking about the man who's cheating with his wife, and he's just like, I can't believe, you know, he's stealing all this food from these poor animals. That's just like this guy just becomes a worse and worse human being because of it going backwards. It's beautiful.
What I loved was the fact that so when the wife has been murdered, she's put back together, so she's born. And when people have died, he describes them as being born. And when people are born, they actually die, if that makes sense. So first of all, he gets back to his flat and he's like, oh, there appears to be this kid now in my family. he's like, and then as the kid grows, the kid is going backwards, so it's getting younger. So its birth is actually its death. But then the other side of that is then he also saves Birdie, the guy who's cheating with his wife, but it becomes a murder because he drags him out of the sea and resuscitates him. So it happens back to front and he's like, well, I didn't really want to do a murder in such a public place, but everyone seemed really happy because everyone's on the beach clapping because he's putting him back in the sea and it looks like he's drowning him. Oh, and the father-in-law as well. They're like, when the little girl disappears behind the screen, so she's supposed to have died, because they're like, the baby's getting smaller and the end had come, but it was okay because the father-in-law's about to be born and they bring his casket up and then like he's waiting to be hatched and he's got this wonderful ornate package, this coffin, so they're waiting for the father-in-law to be born. It's just so crazy.
And then attempting to murder his wife by shoving a fishbone into her throat. And the bit when he's got the scissors and the tweezers and all these things that he's in there. And then I just use my finger because it's a much more delicate tool to try and shove it down in there.
We've got all this stuff. Like I said, we think we know where the story's going, but then it continually surprises us because there's the introduction of the one character, is it Anjenska, later on, and it's like, well, who is this woman? And I totally did not expect her to show up at all. And we just got to see her dressing windows at one point. And then it makes a little bit more sense that we have a mannequin theme that happens because she seems to be a window dresser and she's got all these mannequins. So we at one point visit his house where apparently he was living with this woman. And so that was great that we're able to be surprised in this film, or at least I was able to be surprised because I thought that I knew the whole story because of that voiceover.
But I don't know what I've been watching lately to make me think this, but I thought it was going to be his mother and it was going to be some really weird mother stuff coming because she looks very matronly and motherly. And I just, I don't know, that's kind of the vibe that I was getting at the beginning. And then I was like, oh, no, it's just a regular relationship. And, but I did want to ask, because I recently saw earlier this week the Urs Hertz's the Junk Shop. And that kind of has all these montages of, cut-up images of women. And I know there's at least another Czech film. I've been trying to remember what it was all week, but I feel like it's quite common in Czechoslovakian films of this era to have these kind of cut-up images of women and like these sort of weird bodies and pieces kind of imagery. And then this film, really, really doubles down on it with the cut-up wife being put back together and then the mannequins that this woman is kind of pulling apart and putting back together. And I was wondering is that something that struck you or what did you think that was? Because also at the beginning it opens with the title sequence, which is kind of like these it's a close-up shot of his head, but it's mostly blanked out and the squares slowly kind of appear to reveal his face in pieces.
I don't know. Thoughts? There's a huge amount of montage in these 60s Czech films where they use stills in with live action. That seems to be a common thing. Lipsky uses a lot in Four Murders Are Enough, Darling, where they use montage of comic book pictures of women and stuff in that, which is amazing. But as for actual thoughts on it, by that point, I was just totally go with the flow. I don't think I was having any thoughts. I was just like, what is going to happen next? Because it does really just pull you into this other reality where anything can happen. You just have to completely let go. You know, by the time we're getting murders in the sea and stealing the fish and all that, it's just like, oh, my God, this is so amazing that you just – I don't know. I reached a point where I wasn't even trying to analyze it at all.
I also saw Beauty and the Hertz's Beauty and the Beast, and that opens with your animals being cut apart and slaughterhouse kind of stuff. And this has that as well, that, you know, you open with the woman who's cut apart and back together, and then you end up at his workplace, which is the butcher's, so they're like unslicing open the animals and the guts are going back in, and then they're unkilling them. And so it's like it's got these multiple kind of variations of bodies and pieces being put back together, which was, there's definitely something going on there. And it reminded me of in Necromantic, where Necromantic has the killing of the rabbit in the first half, with the very, very extended sequence of, you know, skinning it and slicing it open and pulling it apart. And then at the end, as he kind of reaches his fulfillment, it plays that again, but in reverse. So it's putting the bunny back together. And I was just like, yeah, I feel like old Jörg Buttergeit had probably been watching some of this as well, perhaps.
Well, I was just talking last week about the cremator, which you mentioned before, and the opening credits to that are just body parts being piled on each other. Like, there's even a poster for it that is just a bunch of body parts just piled together. So I know that was a theme for that as well. But yeah, I can't think of any other cutting apart women films right off the bat. God, which is just so morbid, especially when he's out there in the street with the wife in the suitcase and the cop finally finds him, and the way that the blood is going back into the suitcase.
Yeah. It is so good. I actually have that on my notes, blood in suitcase. Nothing about it, just blood in suitcase. So I was obviously quite amazed by that.
I've never been tempted to do that thing on the Memento desk where you can watch the movie forward. I would actually be tempted to take this movie and flip it and watch it the right way round, just to see how it plays, because those scenes of, you're talking about that bizarro dance that they do, quote unquote, when they're trying to hide the lover in the apartment. I mean, and even when he's our main character is putting on his outfit to go out to be executed, it feels like those were done so exaggerated with their motion, because it just looks wonderful backwards, just the way that the shirt's flipping from the guard's hand to his hand, and the way that he has to shake it out before he puts it on. It is done really wildly with those motions, so it just looks hilarious going back. And even that he had all the feathers coming out of the bed when he's attacking the wife, and it just, you know, they're everywhere and they just start going back into the bed. It just looks so great. I mean, generally, backwards motion is one of those, you know, photographic tricks that always just looks so cheap and cheesy. But that's when it's done in a limited sense. But this thing, the whole movie being run backwards, is brilliant.
I'd love to know how they got that as well, because it looks, although it's exaggerated, it also looks natural. Because totally off topic or sort of on topic, though, I did a piece for Scream on the Fog a couple of months ago, and there was the whole thing about when she's on the top of the lighthouse, it had to be filmed backwards because of the fog. They couldn't get the fog to stay, so they had to film it backwards. And John Carpenter talked about blinking in it. So he had to have all the blinking stopped, because if you blink and it's played backwards, it looks really off. So I was looking at that in this film to see if I could notice it, and no, it's not there. So I'd love to know technically how they choreographed it all. Because even though it is backwards, it looks, it's not awkward in any way. So
maybe it's only 70 minutes, because they ran through so much film trying to get it right. They couldn't afford it anymore, because I work in TV, and, you know, where they're all digital now, so they can just shoot hours and hours. But thinking of, like, oh my God, you've got to shoot this on film, and you've only got so much film, and you've only got so much time. Just, it almost gives me a panic attack just thinking about it.
It's funny that you mentioned the blinking, because having just watched Twin Peaks, The Return, everything that's done in that kind of other world, you know, with the man from another place and the giant, aka the fireman, there's a part where we're just on Andy's face and he's blinking in that, and you can tell that that was shot backwards because of the blinks. So you wouldn't think that you could notice something like that, but yeah, blinking in backwards motion is, yeah, it's very strange.
No, I was specifically looking for it just because I I had it in my mind because I'd written that piece and I was trying to work out how he technically how he'd done it, but you don't notice it. So I wonder if that was, we must have been aware of it and how they got around it, because there's a lot in those scenes. They're really concentrated, as all of Lipsky's comedies. There's always so much going on in a scene, even the narratively speaking normal ones where it runs forward, but always crowds of people running around and all the comedy comes from farce and these stupid situations where somebody's mistaken or trying to kill someone. And, you know, there's all these people involved in the scene that are all doing different things. So it's got that going on, but backwards, which must have been a flipping logistical nightmare, especially as some of the scenes are quite crowded as well, like that dinner table scene. There's like 20 odd people in it all, you know, in synchronicity. So it's quite a marvel, really, from a technical aspect, how... When you think, how was that choreographed? How much did they plan in advance, or did they just go along and experiment, you know? But then they never had a lot of time to make these films. So I just think it's absolutely marvellous in that respect, just from a technical point of view. And the fact that it ends up flawless, what you see on the screen doesn't look awkward or strange, or there's nothing that's out of step. So you accept it, and that allows you to just get drawn in and think, okay, I think if you had weird blinking or anything that was noticeable, it would have thrown you out. And the whole way it works is because you get so absorbed.
I don't know about you guys, but I am sitting here trying to blink backwards at the moment, and it's not easy. I'm like, wait a minute. Okay, yeah.
Well, how do they do the dialogue? Because the dialogue is 99% forwards. So I'm not sure how he even managed to do that. Because when our characters are speaking to each other, yes, the lines are read backwards. But I mean, the order of the lines are backwards, but they're saying them forwards. So, I mean, it's not like Michael J. Anderson where he learned how to speak backwards and then they would redub it so the mouths would match. I mean, this is, it's technically marvelous.
Maybe it's like the old Italian trick where you just get them to count to 20 or something, and it's like you just keep doing that over and over again. Maybe it's something like that where they just figured out like a series of words that they could say that looked right and then dubbed it. I mean, it is a bit hard to tell when you as a non-Czech speaker myself and trying to read the subtitles and follow at the same time, like it kind of hides any like issues there might be, so I can't really say definitively, but maybe it's something like that, because you got to remember the 60s and 70s, the Europe was the absolute like apex of dubbing skills and technology, so it's the right time to be doing it.
No, it does make sense, because it, again, that the lines don't look out of place, as they're said. So, God, we need a making of this film. I want to know. Someone must know. Did Peter Hames know?
You know, I didn't talk to him about this. He doesn't seem to be that into Lipsky. So, I mean, I think, you know, talking to Jonathan Owen a couple weeks ago, I don't think that Lipsky gets the respect that he necessarily deserves, because he was making comedies and I don't think there's a serious film amongst them, but they are serious comedies. I mean, to make an experimental comedy like this takes a lot of guts, and that he always, to your point from earlier, Kat, he always was messing with the way that movies were made, the way that he would stop the frame sometimes, that we would get these still frames, that we would get repeated motion when he's kissing his wife. The film goes backwards and forwards a few times, and he's doing that in everything. This movie is shot in black and white, but it is tinted, though not as tinted as something like Lemonade Joe. But again, in Lemonade Joe, you get little bits of fast motion, you get still frames, and he does that through everything. He was always messing with the way that films were made. I don't think he has one film, especially in his like middle filmography, where he's not messing with the way that films are made and doing something unexpected, as far as, you know, it's not just shot, reverse shot onto the next scene and everything done plain. There's almost always a still frame someplace in there. And if he's not messing with the color in his black and white films, he's doing something. So this guy, to me, was always messing with the form in a great way, pushing the boundaries of it. But again, since he's doing comedy, it's like, okay, whatever. I mean, I can't say he's the Jerry Lewis of Czechoslovakia, but, you know, he definitely was trying different things that we don't see over here in the West as, being, normal, everyday comedies.
If he was working now, then he would be more classified amongst like video artists or VJs or things like that, because it's almost like he's, working a mixing decks to like crash different styles and sounds and images and everything together. And the film feels orchestrated more than like most films I can think of. Like it's just, you almost picture him as a magician, twirling a baton and juggling a rabbit and throwing this into the air and spinning something on his foot all at the same time.
Obviously, I love the Czech New Wave, as do most people. But when people pick out a Lipsky film, the one that's heralded is Lemonade Joe, which, it is a masterpiece. But they tend to, after the 70s, like after the New Wave and when everything got locked down, this period of the sort of 70s and early 80s, for me, is one of my favourite periods of Czech film, because you get a lot of Czech film which is fantasy-based, you've got magical realism, you've got all these really madcap comedies that go into the macabre. They go, like, if you look at Lipsky's later films, or things like Straw Hat, or Adele Hasn't Had a Dinner, or Mysterious Castle in the Carpathians, when he was working with Jan Svankmajer and doing all these amazing animatronics and these weird inventions. You get in those films, he created like this weird Edwardian steampunk gothic. And I think people tend to overlook these films because they're like, oh, well, they weren't Czech New Wave, they weren't satirical, they weren't saying anything about society. So it's almost like this, I wouldn't say snobbery, but it's kind of like a cut-off that, because Lipsky made like family comedies as well, like what's the one about the bears and the clown? That one's bloody brilliant. These bears leave the circus.
Bears and a clown, yeah.
Oh, wow. and it's just the inventiveness in these films. It's like this whole kind of fantasy thing. And Juraj Hertz was doing that in things like Beauty and the Beast. And, at the more surreal end of the scale, you've got Valerie and A Week of Wonders. But for me, he loves fairy tales and kind of fantasy cinema anyway. I bloody love these films. And they went on. Some of them had the big, influence on filmmakers like Neil Jordan when he made The Company of Wolves. Like kind of when American and British fantasy film came along in the 80s and you had things like Dark Crystal and stuff. The Czechs were doing that a decade before. Filmmakers like Lipsky, they just don't get that credit at all. It's kind of like, oh, well, Lemonade Joe was made in the New Wave and then he made all these other silly comedies, but they were fucking brilliant. They were just really and genuinely funny as well, and just masterpieces in editing and every single one of his films, the style and the editing and the amount of work that goes into the set design, the costumes, like these models and things like Mysterious Castle. He's got all these weird little inventions and stuff. They're just mind-blowing. So I don't get why he's not taken as seriously as, say, someone like Svankmajer, who was doing that in animation. I don't understand what this, why he tends to get left off, apart from Lemonade Joe, which was an out-and-out satire. It was critical of capitalism and communism. So one tends to get picked up because you could talk about it quote unquote seriously, whereas the rest, just really just madcap comedies, and they're just enjoyable films, beautifully crafted, really enjoyable films. So
it is
I don't know, sorry, rant over.
Working with the Czech and Slovak Film Festival, and like we always have we're very dedicated to our retrospectives, and we try to keep a reasonable balance between new and old. But just because of being involved and talking to lots of random people, and there have been quite a few times we're talking to random people with just like, oh, the Czech and Slovak still make films. I thought they just, they had their new wave and then that was it. And it's like, I think there's only one Czech film being released in cinemas in Australia this year, The Teacher, and otherwise that's it, and there's no Slovak films being released. And it's just like it's for some reason that region is just still kind of not given the notice and attention that it deserves. And I know that working with this festival, like, we get a huge amount of support from the Czech and Slovak government and culture industries, because they're like, yes, somebody out there is like wanting to put it into the world and share it. And it's just, I don't understand what it is, because even I feel like they, especially with their current films, like the ratio of like good films that are like really, really good films that they're making right now, for like how many films come out, a significant chunk of them are great. Like, really quite great. And they're still, they feel connected to that history. Like, I just saw The Line, which is the Slovak-Ukrainian co-production from the director of The Cleaner. His name escapes me right now. But that has these great moments of kind of magical realism it built into it that are, they're just very small and they're very, like, subtle and they're not overdone, but they're so perfectly placed, and you can feel that connection to the past and the history, and it's still got that same weird, super black but super hilarious sense of humor, even as the world's falling apart. And it's just, yeah, it perplexes me as well as to why it's just like that, that all the people can talk about is that 60s period and that's it.
Yeah, and Lipsky, I mean, he made a lot of shorts before the 1960s. He was a co-director of a couple films. I can't remember if Circus Jetty was a full feature or not, but really when it came to the 60s, he didn't make that many, didn't direct that many films in that golden new wave period. So I wonder if maybe that's why, but he gets left off. But yeah, the 70s were a golden time for this guy. I mean, he hits it right out of the park in 1970 with I Killed Einstein, Gentlemen.
Oh,
which we've talked about before.
That's another one with a weird steampunk Edwardian kind of thing going on. I absolutely love that film. And the little inventions and stuff in it is so great.
Within 4 years, 1970 and 1974, he made I Killed Einstein, Gentlemen, Four Murders Are Enough, Honey, Straw Hat, Six Bears and a Clown, Three Men Traveling, and Joaquin Put It in the Machine. And all of those are terrific.
Straw Hat's fabulous.
It is amazing. I was so happy when I was doing research on Wells a few years ago, and I heard that he had done a version of the Straw Hat, and I was like, oh, the Straw Hat. I wonder if that's the same as the Lipsky film, and I'm glad that I was able to say
that. Oh, it's so good.
And I didn't realize that that was such a staple of comedies, but the way that he did it was just terrific. My God, it is so
amazing.
Good.
It is amazing. See, and also in that period, you've got all this stuff. I think in order to survive that whole regime, people had to make more family-friendly or comedy or kind of go into the Czech version of mainstream. But in that period, you have so much invention. You know, with Uri Hertz was another filmmaker who kind of survived that period. And fairy tales, there's a lot of fairy tales, and it kind of links into, they didn't really make horror films, the Czechs, but they had a lot of films that introduced horror into them just as part of this whole macabre thing. So the mixing up of genres and the invention in that period, like you said, The Little Mermaid, their version of The Little Mermaid is so dark compared to, like, say, the Disney one, and beautiful, really beautiful to look at, but really sad as well. And they were doing things like Three Wishes for Cinderella and all these, like, fairy tales, which, it was just such an amazing period. Second Run have kind of started to dabble in Czech fantasy. So I'm hoping, you know, Baron Munchausen's done quite well, and Three Wishes for Cinderella did quite well, I think, at Christmas. So I'm hoping that kind of creates a market for them to look at doing more of these, because I know from speaking to the guys who work there, they want to. It's just whether the market's there, I guess. So, you know, I'd love to see them restored, because they're such beautiful films. They deserve to be seen properly.
Absolutely. The visual styling is just phenomenal. Like, I don't think I've seen a Czech film from the 60s and 70s that looks, they only look rough because of the quality of the prints. Otherwise, you just freeze them at any moment and you've got a work of art right there. I wonder, talking about that sort of the concentration on those sort of bringing those fairy tales and the sort of fantasy and kind of things, I wonder if it was similar to what was happening in Japan in the post-war period, where part of the reason why they made so many samurai films was that they could, that there wasn't any issues with that. You know, there was no possibility or in the censor's eyes that you were commenting on the government or the situation or the Americans or anything like that. So they kind of retreated to the past because it could appear, at least on the surface, to be less controversial.
Definitely was that going on, but then you do get films that are subversive, like Valerie in A Week of Wonders, where they would kind of sneak these things in. I don't think Lipsky was ever doing that, though. I think he just loved doing what he did, and he was just totally into the fantasy thing. But if they wanted to make films, they had to be accepted because it was all government controlled, and anything that was seen as slightly subversive or critical of the system was out, and you could be... Your career could end if they didn't like what you were doing. They would just say, you're not making any more films, and they'd kick you out, and that would be it. It would be to do something subversive that was openly subversive was career suicide. So yeah. I guess they had to be very careful about what they were doing because of after the Prague Spring, when everything got shut down and loads of filmmakers were just cast out. So, I mean, we talked about that on the Case of the Rookie Hangman episode. So, you know, it was a dangerous time for Czech filmmakers in that anything could be interpreted as against the state, even if it wasn't.
Yeah. So, yeah, well, you used to look at, like, I don't know, Poland is a different country, but similar, like, political system. You look what happened to Zalewski and you know, on a Silver Globe, it's just like, nope, it's just...
Well, Brofchek as well. And Brofchek was making, talking of these weird fantasy films, it was earlier films like Island of Goto and things like that. Similar sort of thing to that whole madcap, very dark, but very dark sort of Czech tradition. So I guess it is a folklore tradition, and folklore is for the Czechoslovak cultural identity, which had been suppressed so much because of the Hungarian rule. You know, the way they kept their language going was through puppet theatre and through fairy tales and through folk tales. And so they hold this real special significance for the cultural identity there, I guess. So in a way, it became like a national thing, you know, a national pride. It's one of the ways they asserted that was through their use of fairy tales. It, you know, we enjoy fairy tales in the West, but they're not so much part of our culture as they are in Czechoslovakian history, where they became, you know, for a large period, the last sort of bastion of their cultural identity was kept in the way those stories were told. So they are very significant to the culture. And I don't know if that somehow played into it or was encouraged, you know, because they had all these, when the communists come along, these farming co-op films and, hey, we love Czechoslovakia, we love our country, we love our land. So I don't know if they were maybe even encouraged to reconnect with that through as a national thing. But it's interesting that it's the fairy tales to them and folklore and fantasy and magical realism have a different significance, definitely, than they do to us.
All right, guys, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back right after these brief messages.
Well, Eric, would you say that we're just two dudes who love talking about movies over at the Culture Cast?
I mean, yeah, I don't know if dudes is the correct nomenclature, though.
Dudes, bros. Okay, what about movie nerds?
No, okay, dudes is fine. Not nerds. Anything but movie nerds.
Well, over here at the Culture Cast, we talk about new movies, overlooked gems, classics, and some films that cause us to question our sanity twice a week.
Yeah, Hot to Trot comes to mind for sure.
Yeah, Hot to Trot was a real mess. So make sure to check out the Culture Cast on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Wife Jessica, I have an idea.
What's that, husband Dustin?
As you know, we love movies.
Yes, dear, I know.
But we also love podcasts.
I'm aware, my love.
And then there's this other part of us that really loves movie commentary tracks.
Get to the point, sweetheart.
Well, if we made a movie podcast / commentary track hybrid audio program, it would certainly be the best married couple movie podcast / commentary track hybrid audio program on the internet, right?
Without doubt. But whatever would we call it?
We are the Popcorn Poops.
Popcorn Poops is a weekly podcast hosted by married couple Dustin and Jessica Kramer.
That's us.
Each week, we choose a movie based on a monthly theme, and then we sit down and record a syncable commentary track as we watch the movie.
But what makes Popcorn Poop special is that you don't have to sync up our podcast to enjoy the show, so you can listen to us like you would any other standalone podcast.
On our show, we like to talk about theory, story structure, genre conventions, and trivia with a healthy dose of dick jokes.
Gotta have the dick jokes.
Subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Play Music.
Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and Instagram for frequent updates about the show, including our weekly movie still identification game.
Visit us on the web at popcornpoops.com. We'll be waiting for you, and not in a creepy way.
Okay, kind of a creepy way.
Yeah, okay, fair warning.
How to continue a television series after a major actor has left the cast.
Part 4, The Robin of Sherwood Method.
Remove the character from the scripts and replace him with an entirely similar character. Create a highly elaborate scenario that puts the new character into the same situation as the original.
The transition is completed when the replacement character adopts the same name as his predecessor. For more about British science fiction television, listen to the British Invaders podcast
at www.britishinvaders.com.
This is Adam Spiegelman from the cult movie podcast Proudly Resents, and you listen to my favorite movie podcast, The Projection Booth. I know. It's messed up, right?
All right, we are back, and we're talking about Happy End, and specifically, I wanted to talk a little bit about the co-writer of Happy End, Miloš Mosorek, who we've already mentioned a lot of the titles that he has worked on, because he and Lipsky worked together on quite a few things, like Four Murders Are Enough, Darling, How to Drown Dr. Marasek, The Lawyer. So even all the way back to Man in Another Galaxy, or what was it? Man from the Galaxy, Man from the Future. I know it's got a few different translations. He worked also a lot with Vaclav Vorlicek as well. And some of those movies are just, those are classics as well. Who Wants to Kill Jesse? You Are a Widow, Sir. Tomorrow I'll Wake Myself Up and Scald Myself with Tea. Was that Vorlicek as well?
Do you know, I don't know, and I love that film as well. If anyone hasn't seen it, just check out the beginning credits and you'll want to sit and watch the whole thing, because it's basically got a disco montage of Hitler. It's a whole, like, twin brother gets mistaken for other twin brother who's choked on a piece of bread and then goes time traveling to kill Hitler. All of his comedy seem to be killing someone.
That was Jindrik Polak.
So good, that film, and absolutely ridiculous, but so funny at the same time. They're again, so morbid as well.
Tomorrow I'll Wake Up and Scald Myself with Tea. That, as a double feature with I Killed Einstein, gentlemen, would be fantastic. These
Killed Einstein is so good. I just said
all the
that
women with their beards.
It definitely, and again, trying to kill Einstein. They're just always trying to kill someone in these comedies or in his comedies. But it always made for great farce, because you'd always get people hiding in cupboards or being mistaken for someone else or pretending they were doing something else, and all these ridiculous scenes of people walking in and out of rooms and all mistaken identity or having to hide things. And so lots of physical comedy and lots of energy in them. But they do fit in with the Lipsky films that he did with Lipsky. So you see those same themes again in the films he did with him. So it's so good, though. So good. And then it's always like some kind of romance that happens as well within amongst this weird murder plot.
Next year, I definitely need to cover a Vorlicek film, because he was another one who just made amazing stuff. And luckily, well, I think for a little while, his stuff was coming out on DVD. I remember Who Wants to Kill Jesse, and What Would You Say to Some Spinach, I think, was pretty easy to find for a little bit. Mosorek also worked on Dusan Vukovic's Visitors from the Arcana Galaxy, which I remember liking a lot.
I haven't seen that one.
It was this whole idea of a science fiction writer who can think things and then they come true, and he manages to bring these aliens to Earth. So yeah, it's good. But yeah, kind of that later period. But, you know, like we said, these guys were making these movies up into the writer, he was making stuff all the way up until he passed away in the early 2000s. This guy has over 100 credits to his name. He still had stuff being done Hell last year. And then obviously Little Witch on a Broomstick was one that he had helped write, and that is still being remade. You know, 2011 there was a version of that. So, and then Wildflowers, which was the last one. I
really like Wildflowers. Is that the one with the yeah, I really like that one. Did he write that?
Yeah, he wrote that as well.
I didn't know that. I really like that one. That's a really good kind of Czech folklore, folk horror kind of thing film.
Apparently, the 2011 version, it's actually a sequel. I'm just looking at it here. It's Little Witch on a Broomstick, 2011, sequel to a Czech cult fantasy comedy, and it's directed by Václav Voldacek as well.
He's I love the working. Original Girl on a Broomstick. That was the one I was talking about earlier, where you've got this weird Hogwarts thing going on, and this witch comes down to Earth and wants to be human or mortal, and it's just crazy. But I've never seen the kind of sequel remake. I knew about it, but yeah, I don't know. The first one's so special, I wouldn't want to ruin it.
Vaclav's like, he's 87 and he's got another film announced, and he made Little Witch on a Broomstick in 2011, so he was 81 when he made that. Clint Eastwood, eat your heart out.
Yeah, but Svankmajer's still making films, and Uri Hertz is still making films, and they're both in their well into their 80s. So it's great you see these guys have such long careers. You know, difficult to talk about because they all made like 100 films, and a lot of them aren't, you know, you can't even find them. So it's brilliant, because I think that's why, I know you were saying earlier, Ben, about how traditions continued, but I know a young Czech filmmaker, Robin, who's working on, who's just done a short based on Stephen King, We Are the Door. We Are the Doorway, and he worked with Uri Hertz and worked with other people because they're still in the industry. They are acting as mentors for these younger filmmakers, which is great because tradition is continuing that way. Yeah, it's because they're still part, very much part of the industry. That era of them hasn't really stopped.
Masurek, he passed away in 2002, so some of these screenplays, it looks like, are remakes of what he had done or based on characters that he had put together. So Wildflowers, Max Sally and the Magic Phone, those are probably some of the last ones that he worked on directly. But I mean, the guy, just to isolate 1 year of his filmography, that he could do The Girl on the Broomstick, Six Bears and a Clown, and Straw Hat all in 1 year, all in 1972, plus more. He had done enough, like with What Would You Say to Some Spinach and Tomorrow I'll Wake Up and Scald Myself with Tea, and on a few other films as well, a few other shorts, just in 1977. Just those two films alone, What Would You Say to Some Spinach and Scald Myself with Tea, those are brilliant. And those are enough for anybody else to... They should be happy that those two films were that they were able to create those two films. And he made so many movies over the years. It's just amazing that he was such a prolific writer and of such great comedy.
Even though they featured these similar plots, all these kind of madcap scenarios, they never ever felt tired. Each one had like completely different ideas, although it was like a similar structure of these same tropes, I guess, that they'd use: mistaken identity, someone being killed or trying to kill someone, they'd use these. But the actual jokes never felt tired, and the actual comedy that he created. So, and they were so dense and carefully crafted and well timed and everything that you just think the rate that he worked at to, you know, solve all these logistical problems and, you know, like we were talking about with the dialogue, writing it backwards and all this, every single one of his comedies I've seen have got that attention to detail. But the rate that he worked at, the man was a fucking genius, really.
We talked a little bit that his films didn't so much have that kind of commentary on the period, but that the kind of feeling of the overall arc of the film. It's like that he's being born and he feels like life should be good and he gets the wife and all these things. But every single time he feels like it's coming together, there's just more and more difficulty piled into his way. And it's just this constant stream of just like, oh, and then there was this and then there was that and there was this. And it just like it reminded me a bit, just slightly, that the shop on Main Street kind of has a little bit of a similar kind of thing where it's like, oh, life will be good because I've got this. Oh, no, actually, it's not good because of this. Oh, but this is the, oh, no, but then there's this. And it's very much feels in tune with that kind of like, well, you know, the political, the social and political structure of the time is that everything is being changed and the rules are getting rewritten and you don't, you know, what you thought would be coming, be normal tomorrow is now backwards. And I feel very much that it may not have been at the forefront of the construction of the narrative, but it feels very infused by that disruptive time period and the loss of traditions and the loss of past.
Yeah, even though this stuff is quote-unquote comedy, I still seem to find subversive elements. I mean, of course, we talked about the way that he's critiquing the ministers and generals, and there were those sly jokes, I think, through a lot of his stuff, though it did get a little safer as we went along, but still, he managed to slide the knife in a little bit with every single movie. There were always little critiques about society, which they might not have been as pointed as, say, The Cremator, but they definitely had some weight to
them. He definitely had this thing about social conventions as well. It's definitely like Lemonade Joe and this one are more subversive, but they were prior to the Prague Spring. But afterwards, when he just went into pure fantasy territory, one of his main things that he loved to have a pop out was social conventions and public gatherings of people. He seemed to find a lot of humour in those situations with people acting ridiculously or people being bad mannered. And he seemed to be having a poke all the time at kind of society's rules or snobbery and that kind of thing. So he was very cheeky, I think. He was a cheeky little filmmaker.
Yeah, and if you're in like an incredibly grim period in political history, like being able to laugh at that, just like with closely observed trains, it's like I only saw that recently and got to the end and sort of went, oh, I actually think that was more subversive than I even realized, because so much of it is just in the being able to laugh at this, to be able to just let go of like the terribleness of what is happening and find humor in it. It completely deflates the terribleness and the nightmarishness of the situations.
Yeah, there's a reason why, even as our main character in that film has been blown to bits, his buddy is laughing at the end of that movie.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take another break and play a preview for next week's show.
Yeah, this is Peter Lorre speaking.
I couldn't resist the temptation to call you. I just read of your new picture that you're to make.
Oh, that's very nice of you. Thanks for your interest.
Oh, I thought you were magnificent in M.
And just the other night I saw your new picture, The Man Who Too Much.
What character are you going to play in?
Oh, it's the most unusual story. You know, it's a great love drama. I'm to be a half-mad scientist.
I, a poor peasant, have conquered science. Why can't I conquer love? He shall be shut up when it's I who am mad. But nobody knows that.
Yes. Each man kills the thing he loves.
Thank you.
That's right. We'll be back next week with a discussion of Mad Love. Until then, I want to thank this week's co-host, Ben and Kat. Ben, what is the latest with you, sir?
Well, as I said, we're in the middle of the Czech and Slovak Film Festival in Melbourne, Australia at the moment. It's our fifth year, and it's going fantastically well. We're doing a Juraj Hertz retrospective. Our theme this year is Neighbours, so we've got a Hungarian retrospective of the Fabri Zoltán films and a whole bunch of like brand new ones. I said The Line, which is fresh from Karlovy Vary. Of course, unfortunately, we are in the middle of it, but we're going to Canberra next month, so I'm completely swamped in Czech and Slovak films and working on the new Romper Stomper TV series by night, which is keeping me very busy and overloaded with Nazis. But such is life in the 21st century, apparently. I've been writing a little bit for the Czech and Slovak blog, so that's if you wanted to see some of my writing, you can go to www.caspa.com.au. That's CASFFA.com.au. I wrote a piece on the shop on Main Street, and I'll hopefully be writing a few more pieces over the next couple of months. So, yeah, very busy.
And Kat, what's keeping you busy these days?
Oh, wow. It's only been a couple of weeks since we last spoke, so not much more has happened apart from I'm desperately trying to finish my Daughters of Darkness book by the end of the month. My publisher is constantly on email going, chop, 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 come on. So that'll be out beginning of 2018, which is on Harry Kummel's 1971 film as part of the Devil's Advocate series. And we've just aired our first ever episode of a new podcast I'm doing with the wonderful Heather Drain, who's always on the projection booth. And we've just done part one on the films of Radley Metzger, and part two should air the beginning of October, which is on these hardcore films, so it's very, very rude. Probably the rudest I've ever heard Heather Drain. She's usually quite polite. So, there's that. And pre-order, please, the next upcoming issue of Diabolique magazine, which is on witchcraft, fairy tales and folk horror, which is coming any day now.
Awesome. Well, I will be sure to link to all that stuff over at the Projection Booth website, projection-booth.com, where you can find out more also about today's episode. I think we've given everybody listening just a ton of movies they should be checking out. I almost feel like this is one of those pure cinema podcasts where it's just like, here's the 10 films that you need to see right now. So, yeah, go out and check out Happy End. Make sure you see Girl on a Broomstick. Tomorrow I'll Wake Up and Scald Myself with Tea. There's so many movies that really deserve a lot more attention that we've talked about this episode. So I'll try to link to as many of those as I can at the website. While you're at the website, you'll also find links over to iTunes where you can rate and review the show, and over to our Patreon where you can make a donation to the show. Donors get early access to every episode as long as I'm not running late, and as long as I can post these episodes while I'm in Shanghai, which is when this episode is supposed to drop, that's where I'll be. So wish me luck on that. Every donation and every rating we get helps the Projection Booth take over the world.
If you enjoy this show and want more people to know about it, head on over to iTunes, leave a comment, and rate it 5 stars. Make sure you like and share us on Facebook, and don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Just search for Christopher Media. Thank you in advance for supporting Christopher Media by clicking on the PayPal button and by clicking through to all the sponsors who support ChristopherMedia.net. Most importantly, we would like to take the time to extend an extra special thanks to you. Christopher Media could not exist without your support. Thank you for visiting ChristopherMedia.net, and thank you for listening. Christopher Media. Let's make some noise.